Hi, everybody. This is Pat Green. You're listening to Walking the Floor. My buddy Chris, ain't he something?
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor. Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Shiflett, and you are listening to episode number 165 of your favorite podcast, Walking the Floor. Ladies and gentlemen, I got nothing to tell you. I got nothing to sell you. I got nothing going on at all. Just like everybody else, I assume. Nothing going on here much, but I have been using this downtime wisely. Or I don't know about wisely, but I've been using it to write a bunch of new songs. So hopefully when all is said and done and the lockdown is over, I will emerge from quarantine with at least one new record written. Maybe two new records. Maybe three. Who knows? Maybe it'll be time for me to do my own personal Sandinista, if you know what I'm saying. We'll see. We'll see how long it lasts. Indeed. More importantly, did you know that Zounds has three warehouses strategically located across the United States to get your gear to you faster than anyone else out there peddling music gear on the internet? Over 90% of Zounds orders arrive within 2 days or less. That's just as fast and as good as Amazon Prime, but thank God you don't have to pay for it, baby, because shipping is free at Zounds.com. So get on over to Zounds.com today. All right, let's get to today's interview. All right, so you know my man Pat Green is Texas to the bone. He's a legendary Texas singer-songwriter and a wonderful character to boot. And we had a great rambling Zoom remote conference conversation a few weeks back and talked about everything from, you know, how he first started out to, like, you know, playing poker with Willie Nelson to playing stadiums, man, everything. We talked about everything there was to talk about. And he even plays a snippet of a new song he's been working on and one of his classics as well at the end. And, you know, it being Zoom and having to be sort of subject to the quality of the internet, the sound quality is a little rough, but the vibe is all there, babe. So make sure you stay tuned all the way through to the end. This is Pat Green on Walking the Floor.
Never you want me to.
If Willie Nelson and Bruce Springsteen and Jimmy Buffett had a kid, it would look like this. You know, I'm not trying to change the world. I just want to make people happy.
There is that weight when you're writing songs of, like, that can almost kind of trap you creatively, where you're like, if you're sitting there comparing yourself to Dylan and John Prine and Bruce Springsteen, it's like, how do you ever get any words on a page? You know, you're like, you're never going to be that, you know, you have to just let that stuff go.
Well, my method is pretty simple. I try to create a character. And if that character is Willie or Springsteen or whomever, that's the vein that I, when I'm trying to write, you know, get out and express what I'm trying to express, I just go into that character and I can be that person for a moment. And I can sing like Springsteen. You know, I can do
that. I mean, that's the interesting thing I think about, like, character songs like that, is that even when you're not writing, even if it's like you're inhabiting this character and you're writing something that's, like, fictional, it's sure, you're still drawing from your own life experience. And I think that's the, you weave that in there, and that's the thing that makes it ring true somehow for the listener.
I could not agree more, Chris. I think that I'm the happiest guy I know. I as far as I know, a lush, a complete drunk. But I have to weave in and out of all of that to express myself and to be on stage and make others happy. That's really the whole thing that I'm looking for, is to make other people enjoy their lives. That's I'm not worried about being Guy Clark or John Prine or any of the greats. I'm the court jester.
Well, you know, it's funny, with this whole lockdown thing that we're going through, I don't know if you've been doing any like Instagram live streams where there's like, you know, everybody's kind of doing, I've been doing a bunch of them. And it is a funny thing because as...
That's like, you're doing a lot of everything. I 25 of your podcasts in the last 5 days. You're nonstop, man.
Well, it's funny. I have a little studio not too far from our house. And like, I feel like if I just get in my car and drive straight there, there's nobody here. I don't encounter anybody. It's like I'm being I'm keeping my social distance and all that sort of thing, but I can still get out of the house, give my family a break, and it's nice. So I can come over here and tinker and then go home and drive everybody crazy. But I was, what I was getting to was, with the live stream thing, it's funny. Like you said, you know, the idea is to make people happy. You're a performer. You want to get up on stage. You want to give somebody a soundtrack to their Saturday night or whatever it is. And this live stream thing is like really screwed that up because there's no applause at the end of it. You play your song and it's just nothing. And like, and while you're playing, there's like people commenting and then you start reading the comments and that's sort of like the applause, but then you forget your lyrics. It's like, it's a real, like, it's a strange exercise for like, you know, performers.
I don't know exactly how to answer that question, if it was a question, but I really know that, the lack of applause in my life right now is it's a drag. It's I gotta say, and my wife, she's hilarious, right? She's super smart. She's, you know, she's law. She graduated with a law degree and now she's an artist as well and she makes jewelry and so forth and so on. But I think the reason why we're arguing most of the time right now is because I'm here where I'm not supposed to be here. And that's why we're arguing, is because I'm supposed to be out there, you know, playing shows in Houston and Austin and wherever else. But I'm here and a lot here.
It's funny. I remember when I first started dating my wife, there was this French guy. My wife was a stylist at a magazine when we first started dating. And awesome. I was on tour. She's beautiful. Love her. She was on a shoot somewhere. And I think maybe I was on tour or something. She was complaining to everybody that was there. Oh, you know, I miss my boyfriend or whatever. And this French guy on the set said, sometimes it is good to miss.
My thing that I keep in my wallet was a piece of paper that she gave me that says, distance lends enchantment to the view.
Yes. The more distance, the better sometimes. you talked about you're supposed to be out playing shows. Like, what has this whole thing upended for you?
Well, you know, obviously the band and I we're trying to keep close. We talk every day. To be honest, if you're being frank about it, I'm borrowing a lot of money to keep everybody, but that's hard. But at the same time, it's really not. It's kind of a thing where I feel like it's bringing us closer, if that's, you know. And so we're writing songs like we're doing right now. I'm writing songs with my guys like this.
Oh, cool.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, hey, what do you think about this? And then, you know, the songwriter thing. Well, I think this is really terrible, but here we go.
That's when you know the people you're writing with are really comfortable with you.
Right. It sucks, but
I've never quite gotten that one, but I have gotten you play an idea and then the other guys in the room kind of go, what else you got?
Okay, speaking of that, that's hilarious. Okay, Guy Clark, you know Guy?
Yeah, sure.
Man, okay. The first time I ever met Guy Clark was with, he was doing a show in Lubbock where I went to school at Texas Tech. And he was doing a show with Ramblin' Jack Elliott. And I went to the show, and there is my manager, George Corey. Watch that. See ya.
Look at that. Boom. Straight to voicemail, George.
Anyway, so I went out to see Guy Clark and Ramblin' Jack Elliott. And, I was one of those, I'm kind of a go-getter, you know. And I went to the show, and then after the show was over, I brought my guitar back, and they were all having drinks in the bar, you know, at late night. Uh-oh, message. Anyway, and I had only written like one or two songs in my life. And the one that I played for him was Dance Hall Dreamer, which was the title track off my first very, very freshman record.
Sure. Anyway,
so I played him that song. And the guy looked up after I played it. He looked at me and goes, "What else you got?" And I realized at that moment that I was a freshman.
Did you ever wind up writing any songs with him or any of those guys?
I spent a lot of nights on his couch just being friends, and the songs that we wrote, he's the deep end of the pond, I'm the shallow end of the pool. And I don't think it ever worked out as far as the songwriting, but our friendship was real.
Right.
And so I didn't really care I didn't care what happened. I'd bring two bottles of wine and some food over, and we'd write and smoke weed and which is what you do.
I would imagine just being in that guy's presence, you'd pick up some songwriting pearls of wisdom along the way.
There has never been one greater than him.
Yeah.
That I know of.
Yeah.
And being around him and playing, he made his own guitars. And if you got to go to his house, the songwriting room and so forth was in the basement, and where he made his guitars, and he would play his guitars, which were fantastic. I mean, I don't know how else to say it. I mean, like, Collins guitars are great guitars. Gibson guitars are great guitars. Guy Clark guitars are Guy Clark guitars. And you're playing them, and he made them with his own hands. And so that's what's,
I mean, they must be nice, because I've never seen one for sale anywhere.
Never.
You know what I mean?
Never. I never even asked. And I think it would have been rude to ask.
Yeah, right.
No, I mean, he's the greatest that ever lived.
I mean, what led you to write songs? Like, what, there's that point, like, for a young musician, where you pick up a guitar, you join a band, you're doing your thing, you're playing the songs by the bands you love or trying to or whatever. And then there's that point where you kind of go, wait a minute, maybe I could put one of my ideas together. Like, what, but that takes a certain, like, I don't know what that takes. That takes
leave a certain, faith.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's a certain amount of ego, a certain amount of confidence. Ego's, you know, right. What I mean? Yeah. Ego, like, right. What, how did that start for you?
I think that what I learned to do was tell the truth. My truth, whatever story I was telling, I had to tell that truth. And that's why when I was writing songs in college, it was all about getting hammered and driving down the road to see Willie Nelson, Robert O'Keefe, Jack Ingram, all those guys. That was it. That was all that mattered to me, was doing that. And so then as I fell in love with my wife, now 25 years together, that story became more, my son, my daughter, those stories became more a part of everything. I don't derivate from that very much.
When did you start playing out? Like, when did you start playing live? Did writing songs and just playing, period, and being a performer all kind of start in like college age for you? Were you doing that in high school?
No, not high school. I didn't do anything but play basketball and baseball and be an idiot. But I think that I met a few people. I met David Henry. I met Paige Blanton. I met Brian Zintgraff. I met a few guys that were like, "Hey, man, you can play guitar." And I was like, "Yeah, I'm not very good at it, but I can play it." And they introduced me to other guys like Corey Morrow and Jack Ingram, et cetera, et cetera. And then we just started writing songs. And It was a very natural sophomore in college kind of process. I just, you know, and that's when I fell in love with making people happy. I'm not trying to change the world. I don't want to be Neil Diamond.
Wait, so did you just say that, did you know Jack Ingram in college? Is that what you said?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Were you guys both just kind of starting out? Is that about the right time?
He was about a year before me.
Oh, okay.
And what I always said is that if he can do it. I'm not gonna lie. I was a bit of a school teacher for Jack. I'm not saying that I'm the sharpest stick in the bag, but man, you know, like one time Jack was playing at the Depot Warehouse in Lubbock, and there was no opening act, and I knew that because that was my joint where I always went to hang out and listen to live music. And so the guy who owned the place, I walked up to him and I said, "Hey, Jack Ingram, my name's Pat Green. Jack Ingram wants me to open for him tonight." And he was like, "Okay, fine. How much money do you want?" I was like, nothing. And then I went to Jack Ingram and I said, "Hey, the folks from the Depot Warehouse want me to open for you tonight." And there we go.
How did you know to do that? Like, that's something that for most people...
I'm a sneaky bastard.
Because, I mean, that sort of supports my point. I always told my kids, like, because, you know, they go out, they're a little older now, and they go out to shows and stuff. And I always explain to them, like, if you just walk up to a backstage at a club or an arena or anything, you just act like you own the place and you just look at people like, what the fuck are you looking at? You're just going to walk, you're going to breeze right. No one's going to question you. If you come in all scared, then they're going to be like, "Hey, what are you doing?" But that just kind of supports that.
You have a
phone
here. You're like, "Listen, I did Jack Ingram. Piss off. I'm going in."
Yeah. Where's Jack Ingram? that's amazing. I was gonna ask you how you convinced Lloyd Maines to produce your first record when you didn't have a record deal or whatever, but I think you might have just answered that question. Did you just show up to the studio like, "Okay, what time are we starting today, Lloyd?"
I think Lloyd was just desperate for money. We did six records with Lloyd.
Really?
I did six of them in my life.
Well, I mean, how did you get him to do that when you were first starting out?
My bass player at the time was Michael Terabay, and he went out, he was at school at South Plains College, where Lloyd's daughter, Natalie Maines of the Dixie Chicks, she was also in school, and I said, "Michael, let's make a record." And he goes, "All right, well, call Lloyd. He knows how to, he's a producer and he's got the studio all set up." The next thing I knew, I was having lunch with Lloyd Maines at a Mexican food restaurant, and he said, "Play me your songs." And I literally sat there with the guitar at the Mexican food restaurant and played the songs, and it's a freshman effort for sure. I don't want to, you know, there's still some of them that we play every night. One of them is played for the Texas Rangers, the baseball team, every home game win, Texas, I Like Texas plays.
Isn't that sort of the curse of like a successful musician, is that it's your earliest stuff is the stuff that everybody calls out at the shows, and it's the stuff that you care the least about, I say a curse, it's a good curse to have, you know, if there's anybody that wants to hear your songs, that's a good curse to have, but it is a funny thing.
Ray Wiley Hubbard said it best: if you write a song, you better be prepared to sing that son of a bitch for the rest of your life.
It is the responsibility when you put out a record, that is for sure. Just expect it. Expect some bad reviews too.
Hey, let me ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
When was the last time you were nervous in front of a big crowd?
Whew. Nervous in front of a big crowd. I tell you what, you know, I get excited at those big shows with Foo Fighters more than nervous. I think the nerves are usually like if we have a new album out and there's a couple of songs in there that are brand new that you still haven't, it's not second nature, that'll get you a little nervous, you know what I mean? But like the reality for me is that I'm so much more comfortable and sort of native just being a guitar player off to the side, as opposed to like when I go out and do my solo gigs, there might be only 50 people there, but God, they're right there. And it's, and I've got to carry the whole thing and I got to tell a little funny story between songs. And some nights it just doesn't work. You know what I mean? It's just crickets and you're like, ah. So for me personally, those shows are make me a lot more nervous.
Yeah, I find myself, I find 50,000 people to be much more comforting than
500. Yes. Because those big shows, it just becomes a force, you know, it's just this, like, it's just this power to it. I mean, you know, it's the same idea. It's like there's, if you're playing in front of 100,000 people, those 100,000 people came to get down. Well, let's get back to like the sort of early years of you starting out. So you, before you made your first record, I mean, were you already generating, like, were you already starting to develop a live draw?
Yeah, we were a cover band, like a lot of people. You know, played a lot of Robert Earl Keen, a lot of Jerry Jeff Walker, Willie Nelson, et cetera, et cetera. Even Jack Ingram, Waylon Jennings, et cetera. But yeah, I mean, that's all we did. There was a place called the Depot Warehouse and the Depot Beer Garden, both were kind of side by side, that we would play once a week. And then there was a Stubbs Barbecue. Yeah, I don't know if you, I'm sure you've heard of Stubbs in Austin.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah.
But there, the original Stubbs was in Lubbock, where we were going to school at Texas Tech. And so I played there every Wednesday night. We played those places, you know, and yeah, to the beer drinking crowd that wasn't listening.
But did you get a sense like that people were starting to come back for you? Like, did you already sort of have that sense of something building?
Well, I mean, I don't want to be overconfident and say that that was part of it, but that certainly, the fact that the places were always full gave me the confidence to move forward and to lean, you know, if you will, lean over my skis. And that's when I started writing. And that's kind of when I developed a sense of self.
You know, you never want to believe everything you read on the internet, because most of it is not true about people, but I did read something somewhere. Is it true that like your stepdad fired you from a job to sort of give you motivation to go out there? And
well, I mean, I had made $20,000 one weekend in a, you know, this stupid bar gig stuff. And my part of my job working with him was to collect money from the gas stations where we sold gas to the gas guys. Anyway, long story short, he asked me if that was his money or my money. And I said, it's my money. And he scooped it all up and took it into his office. And he said, let's count it out. And then he fired me. Yeah,
that's, that's amazing. Like at the time, were you like, thanks, buddy.
Yeah, if you can do it one weekend, you can do it every weekend. And now, 25 years later,
And your first record you put out yourself, right?
Well, with borrowed money, but yeah.
Right. Yeah, and what was that like? Like, I'm curious, you know, for a guy like you, like you've been, you know, you've self-released records, sold them at your shows or out of your back of your car, whatever. And to all the way to being on, like, you know, major labels and doing that whole thing. I'm curious to get your take on what it was like as an indie artist when you were starting out versus what it's like now.
That's a fair question. I think I was so excited to have anything with my recorded voice on it. I would have sold it for a dime. It didn't really matter. I was so excited to be in the music business in the beginning, and it didn't. And even now, I really feel the same way now. I'm not sure that there's anything better than exciting other people. But okay, so from being the freshman, if you will, and the new songs and Lloyd Maines, I got to be around really professional musicians, etc., to going to Universal Artists and RCA and being published by anyway, blah blah blah, writing with Rob Thomas and you know, all that stuff, to me, it's such a wash. It's I would imagine it's the way you feel about the time that you joined the band until now, where it's just like,
right.
It just goes so fast.
Yeah.
And all I can think about is being on a tour bus with Kenny Chesney and Dave Matthews and Keith Urban and all the bands that I've gotten to tour with. It just, you know, it's so fast. But I enjoy
it. I wish I had kept a journal. That's what I think.
Damn it. You said it. Yeah. My thing is that I tell my wife every time is I wish I'd have taken more pictures.
Totally. I mean, it really is like when you're speeding through it, and you're always in a rush, you know, especially when you're younger, to get to that next thing and the next level of your career and the next. You gotta get to the gig, and then you gotta get to the thing. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's a lot of it's just gone, you know.
Yeah, but isn't that great though?
Yeah,
because you know it's
down the memory hole.
Exactly, and when you're sleeping, barely sleeping in the, you know, the early morning hours, some of that comes back while you're almost asleep.
Well, it's a funny thing, you know, because we were like the last generation of not having like every moment of your life documented with your
thing.
So now when a picture pops up, when somebody sends me, oh, look at this picture I found from like a tour in 1996 or something, you're like, whoa, it really like, for as fast as it flies by, that seems like many lifetimes ago.
I don't even know how to begin that conversation. It's such a righteous statement. I sit with my kids and I'm like, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry that I missed half your life, you know?
Yeah.
But the pictures that I have, that when I walk down my stairs that are right outside that wall, are pictures of me and them, and I get to have that back for just a moment. And my daughter one time told me when I was leaving to go out on the road I was on tour with Chesney for a couple of years, and she said, "I'll see you on TV, Daddy."
Aww.
I was like, "God dang it!"
You know what I learned when my kids were pretty young? You never want to leave for tour at night. There's just something very, very depressing about leaving your house at night. And I remember one time I was like going to Australia or something on a night flight. And my son, who never really did this
much. What's your son's name?
And my oldest son is Liam. I have Liam, Dashiell, and Eamon, my three boys.
Kellis and Rainey.
Nice. And my oldest son, who was pretty young at that point, you know, did that thing where he started crying and he reached out to me, "No, don't go," kind of thing. And it just like, I remember just getting to the airport in tears, just like, I'm never leaving at night again, man. So much easier when they're at school.
Yeah, my wife used to always say, "Don't leave me." And I'm like, "This house ain't free." I don't want to say.
Well, when did it become, when did that moment kind of happen for you where you like, or did you ever have this moment where you kind of go, "Whoa, this is for real. Like, I think I'm going to pull this off. This is for real."
I wrote a song with my friend Walt Wilkins called "Carry On." And the Texas Country Radio at the time was coming off of Garth Brooks, Clint Black. Everything was kind of going that way. Right. Remember when Garth was the whole world?
Right.
Clint Black. All those great, they were great bands and all that. And it was great country music, but it was not so much, it was kind of plastic, if you will.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And then when it came down the other way, it was when kind of the Dixie Chicks and more acoustic driven, more just, you know, well, not so plastic.
Right, right.
And I'm not trying to give, you know, something bad to Garth and those guys, but more power to you. Well done. But I was just standing there, right? That's when it happened. That's when all the lights came on for me, and I started writing songs that were decent, you know, and not so sophomoric. And I'm not trying to say that there were anything in the neighborhood of Todd Schneider or Bob Schneider. Or, you know, I'm not, like I said, not trying to change the world. I'm more of a Jimmy Buffett kind of Texas songwriter guy. Just let it happen and people happy. But Carry On came on, and we got Universal Records picked us up. And then they did a video. We were in Bedford, Texas, which is kind of the mid-cities between Dallas and Fort Worth. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, 6 million people between Dallas and Fort Worth, and it was one of the middle cities near Arlington. Anyway, like 35,000 people came out to that show, and I'd never seen anything like that. And they did this huge video that ended up on CNT, and this song just kind of, it got all over the radio. It just got everywhere. And from that point, it was just hold on.
Right.
Just see what happens. And what a blast. It was.
Well, what was that like to get that record deal with a major label? Now all of a sudden it's all over the radio. Yeah. You hear nightmare stories, you hear great stories. What was like what was that whole culture, major label culture in the, you know, mid 90s or whenever that was, like for you?
Have you ever met an A&R guy? Right.
Well, I'll tell you, when I interviewed Jack Ingram, he had a great comment about that. Like he said, when he went to Nashville, he sort of came to town like, I'm here to save country music, kind of thing. And that, you know, folks in the industry was like, fuck you, we got this, we're doing just fine without you, bud, you know.
Well, Jack Ingram, he's the greatest fuck you guy of all time.
Right.
I've never met a man that knows how to say. Okay, here's the story. This is a good story. I'm gonna. You can use this or not. But the night that I met Jack Ingram, I was dating my wife, who's it's been my wife for a long, long, long time. But I went backstage and had him sign my guitar. And I was back there just playing guitar with him, singing songs and having fun, you know, doing the old Guy Clark thing, doing the Jerry Jeff thing, the Robert Earl King, and on and on and on. He's playing his songs, I'm playing my songs. And my wife, I didn't tell, well, my girlfriend, who's not my wife, didn't know where I was. And she came back and found me and Jack just hanging out, drunk as skunks. I mean, shit canned, hammered. And she walked in the door and she goes, fuck you, Pat Green, and fuck you too, Jack Ingram. to this day, whenever they see each other, that's the howdy. It's fuck you, Corey Green.
Was that the moment that the light bulb went off, like, I'm going to marry that girl?
I don't know. I'm not sure if she wanted to marry him or me, but whatever it was, that's who I married. I had to marry a person that is that way, a person that is tougher than me.
Right.
Harder than me.
Yeah.
Harder than me. Somebody that just kind of says, hey, I understand that you're really cool. Take the trash out.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's the part of your life that keeps your feet on the ground, you know?
Or really just irritates you all the time.
Yeah, either way. My wife's always like, hey there, bud, you're not on tour. You're not at the Four Seasons there, buddy. There's nobody here to pick up after you. Come on. Let's unpack that suitcase. Let's go.
Love of Four Seasons. Love of Four Seasons. I wish I was interviewing you.
Hey, man, start a podcast. I'll be your first guest.
Your thing with Robert Earl and with Todd Snyder and with Jack, but I thought we were first class. I mean, it was not like, and I'm not trying to blow smoke. I'm just saying, like, you genuinely put some effort into getting to know the subject matter and so forth.
Robert Earl Keen was so great. I had never met that dude, and he was so funny. I wanted him to interview me or me interview him, like, for another 5 hours.
He was the star. Him and Jerry Jeff and Willie were the three guys where I was just like, okay, I don't have to worry about telling stories like that, but, you know, like 5 Pound Bass and Road Goes On Forever and Pissing in the Wind and as you know, you can go all the way down if you want, but man, those guys and their storytelling made me feel like, okay, I can do this. And then Jack Ingram, who was my age, I felt like, okay, now I can really do this.
Right.
And that's what gave me the confidence.
Well, you know, those are some of the names that we know. You know, we know you and Jack and Willie and Guy Clark and Townsman, you know, all this lineage of Texas singer-songwriters. But who are some of the folks that somebody like me would have never heard of? Like, who are some local guys that, like, maybe were an influence on you or somebody that was a couple steps ahead of you that, like, that never made it to me?
I don't know if you know Bob Snyder.
No.
Waylon Payne.
Sure.
I did actually see on your list Chris Stapleton, Rodney Crowell, Jim Brewer, my favorite comedian of all time. But the one that I was trying to get at, Foy Vance.
Oh, yeah. Foy Vance. What a cool dude.
Holy moly. I can't believe that was on your list. Rodney Crowell, of course.
I tell you, the Jim Brewer interview is a funny one because
everything that he does is hilarious.
Well, everything he does is funny, and of course I'm a fan of his. But the way that came about was really funny. The guy, my buddy Davis, who helps me book this podcast, had thought that he was booking Jim from My Morning Jacket, and I was like, oh great, you know, yeah, I'd love to interview Jim. And he calls me the day of the interview and goes, hey, I got my wires crossed there with the publicist. I thought it was Jim from My Morning. It's actually Jim Brewer, the comedian. And I was like, oh, that's cool. That's great. You know, great. You know, I'll just change my questions. Yeah. It's a very different interview. But, you know, we were able to connect on, you know, our love of 80s heavy metal.
I was trying to pick up Keith Gaddis.
Keith Gaddis, yes. Oh.
Well, if you're listening to this just because of whatever reason, if you don't go check out Keith Gaddis, you're crazy.
Keith Gaddis, great songwriter, producer, and solo artist, of course, over the years. And probably from a lot of people know him from his time playing with Dwight Yoakam. Blame the Vein. I met Keith Gaddis through Rami, that plays keyboards with Foo Fighters. And I'll tell you, I was in Nashville a few years ago recording, and I think it was when I interviewed him, actually. I went over to his house and interviewed him, and I said, oh, I'm here recording. He goes, oh, you want to borrow my B-Bender? I think we had talked about the B-Bender or whatever. So he loaned me his B-Bender, which I'm terrible at those things, but, you know, I love, you know, I can kind of fake it a little bit just to get a track. But
every guitar, so
He loaned me his B-Bender, and I brought it back to him at the end of my time there. And then I didn't see him for like a couple of years. And I played at a thing with him where he had his B-Bender at Kendall Marvel's Honky Tonk Experience at the Exit Inn. Years later, you know, and so I see him. I'm like, hey, man, how you doing? He goes, man, my B-Bender was all fucked up. I haven't played that thing since I loaned it to you. I don't know what I did.
That's another way he talks and sings. It always has an SH at the end. That is Dale Watson.
Oh, Dave, yeah.
Bentley.
Yeah.
Al. Holy moly. Lucas Nelson, with a sweetheart, last Christmas. we went to Hawaii with my family, and Willie had us over to play some poker, and he got me stoned, and I lost all my money. I mean, I'm like, and there's Lucas over there playing chess with Donnie Nelson. I'm like, okay.
Was Willie like, I bet I'm going to bring out my extra super crypto weed, take this guy's money.
He knew what was happening. He knew he was stealing my money. I just had to back my chair away and say, okay, when the Uber comes, I'll be right here.
I mean, you've known Willie for long? Like, when was the point in your life where you started to sort of meet some of these heroes?
I did the same thing with Willie that I did with Jack Ingram. I told the bar that Willie wanted me to open, and then I asked Willie's people as they got there that night because they didn't have an opening act. It was kind of like, you know, it was easy pickings in Lubbock, Texas. There was no opening acts.
Right.
And so I was just walk up on the bus, and that's how I met Pootie Locke. I don't know if you know Pootie.
No.
Willie's stage manager for 35 years, God rest his soul. But, I walked up to Pootie, and I said, hey, if you'll get me an opening act tonight, I'll play at your bar two nights for free in Austin. He's like, done. But that night, I ended up, you know, pushing gear. I'll never forget it. And it was at the, what's it called? The Library was the name of the bar. And I ended up pushing gear up onto their 18-wheeler. And when it was over, David Anderson, who was the tour manager, and, you know, Pootie kind of brought me around. He says, hey, this guy opened for you, and he pushed gear all night. And Willie reached in the money bag and threw me $1,000.
No shit.
I caught it. You know, it was like it was in a rubber band. I caught it, and I was like,
wow.
And then I had to do shows for free for Pootie.
That does not suck. Having Willie Nelson throw you a grand. I mean, now that you've been doing this for a long time, like, who are the guys that are up and coming now that you have that role to? Who are you throwing $1,000 to at the end of the night?
Oh, right. Nobody. First of all, I'm not willing to, so I don't have that kind of cash. But
$20. Let's just cut it down.
I think guys like William Clark Green, Cody Johnson, those guys are doing really well. I think Cool Wetzel is, I think it's kind of like, I listen to him and I see this kind of, he's going to evolve. And a lot of people got on me about how crazy and silly my songs were. But if you look at the Beatles with I Want to Hold Your Hand until Revolver, there was an education in music that came in that time.
Right.
And so that's what I look for out of those guys. And I think that that it's going to be Aaron Watson comes to mind.
Mm.
I just think that there's expect more and you'll get more. Right. And that's really what I did for myself. I started learning how to, I didn't want to be Pat Green. I wanted to be Will Hogue, I wanted to get to the point where I could, be something more. And
right.
It takes time, period.
That's the hard part, giving people time to develop.
Chris, I think you and I have both been through it. The washer, if you will. There's no other way. Dale Watson actually one time told me, I was hanging out with him one night, and I said, how do I get into Europe? How do I get to, play shows over there? And he's always been a very forthright, very honest person. And he goes, Pat, you're going to have to figure that out for yourself. And I thought that was a great line. I was like, that's spot on, man. Yeah, okay, I'll go do it. I'll figure it out.
Yeah, it's good advice. Throw you in the deep end of the pool.
Exactly.
On that end, are like, what is going on? What do you have planned? You know, obviously we're all stuck in our houses for the immediate future, but do you have plans to make a new record or?
Yeah, actually we're writing right now. We're about six. I have eight, but I'll say six are okay. But we haven't made a record in years, and so it's time. And I think at this point, when everybody's kind of searching for something and looking for whatever, I don't really care if we sell music one song at a time, as it has been for years. I think right now people are looking for anything. Right. I've been reading a lot and writing. I'm not writing the Great American Novel, but I have a pretty fun story to tell.
Well, like an autobiography or a fictional?
No, it's just a story. It's a fun story. It's a kid's story. But it's hilarious, man. It's about a 12-year-old girl that has found immortality, and she's living as a 100-year-old lady living in New York City, stealing cigarettes and cussing at people. It's funny. Anyway, that's coming. I'm a couple hundred pages into that. Obviously, I'm doing a lot of art. And you know, I'm same as you, man. I wake up every day, and if you know, my wife will say, "What are you doing today?" I don't know. I wake up and I'm making this shit up as I go, same as you.
Yeah, aren't we all?
Silver beard. How did you keep your beard from going silver?
Oh, it's silver. It's just I've got kind of a shadow on it right now. Yeah, no, it's there's some patchy grays for sure. It's in there. I got like my natural going gray thing is like, yeah. I have those like the wings down the side, you know?
Yeah.
The silver fox.
The silver fox. When are y'all going back on the road?
Well, we were supposed to start this week. So that's all been upended. I mean, we have a new album in the can and we were supposed to get at it.
You good? Do you like it?
Yeah, really good. Yeah. It's exciting. But I don't know. The real answer is I don't know. So hopefully sooner than later, but you know, we're all, until then, let us live stream. Speaking of that, would you like to play a song?
I would love to. I'm gonna play this one I've been writing.
Oh, nice.
I think it's cool.
It's a scoop.
When daylight gives to darkness, this is me going into my Springsteen character. That's nice. How I'm writing, right? When daylight gives to darkness, loneliness subsides. When the pain turns to thunder, that's when it all comes alive. It breaks you from the inside. It just can't get out. It's the ecstasy in me that's what makes you all feel alive. Right? Sometimes the hangover's bigger than the drink. Sometimes the party just hangs on. Come on. Right? So that's what I'm writing right now. So
nice.
Right? That's a little. Anyway.
Yay! Thank you, sir. Dig it.
Play a song for you. All right, here we go. Drop D, which makes it even.
The grunge key.
Yes, it makes it more better. Look at my fingers because I cut two of them off. Maybe just a little bit tired of the city. Billboards and bullshit got it down. Seems like you need a little help, country. Yeah. A little back roads driving, a little bit of old top down. And everybody gotta get away sometime. Forget about yourself for a while. So
sorry, this guitar is not being totally in tune, but seem to me that all you need is a ragtop car to ride with me. Okay, this is terrible. All right, just mind get a little high tonight. That's okay. That's all right. Carry on. I don't have any roadies right now. Old Walt Wilkins, well, he lives back in Nashville. You know his eyes have seen the mile. Walt, why don't you jump in Jim T's caddy and come down to Texas and drink with me a while. Yeah, everybody gotta get away sometime. Forget about yourself for a while. We'll go down to El Arroyo, we'll have some tacos and beer, baby, let ourselves go. That's all right. Just might try to get it right tonight, that's okay. All right, carry on. It's a really long song. I'm sorry, Chris.
Love it.
I'll cut out the solo, right? And life will make sure that you got your troubles. And life will make sure that you work too hard, yeah. Ain't nobody that don't get tired of watching troubles pile up big in your own backyard. Yeah, and sometimes you gotta grab your world with your own two hands. Said it's spinning off on a course all your own. Take yourself a big bag for your shoulder. We used to say fat sack. Take yourself a fat sack for your shoulder. Find yourself some good times and bring them on back home, home. Everybody gotta get away sometime. Forget about yourself for a while. If you live your whole life up there on that shelf, you got no one to blame but your own damn self. That's what. Oh, and heaven only knows what's going to happen. That's okay. All right, carry on. Show off, right?
Yeah!
Now love that's it. Jimmy Buffett married Bruce Springsteen.
Exactly. Perfect. That's a good combination. Take my hand.
All right, that was Mr. Pat Green on Walking the Floor. I should mention that I saw that he's doing one of those concert in your car gigs on June 6th. I think he might even be doing a couple of them, and it's down in Arlington, Texas. And I think they might be sold out, but check it out. You know, maybe they're not. Maybe you can sneak in there or sneak, you know, climb into somebody's trunk and just sneak into the gig. Like you're going to a drive-in movie, I guess is how that works. I'm not really sure. All right, that's it for this week. Tune back in 1 week for another incredible episode. I don't know who's the guest is going to be, but it'll probably be somebody great. I got a lot in the can right now, and I got to get through them, baby. This is the new summer schedule. Once a week, tune in. All right, that's it for this week, kids. Adios, amigos!